From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we talked to playwright Lee Noel about a radio drama premiering on GPB Radio and podcast this weekend. Reasonable Doubt, the Troy Davis Project, reflects multiple opinions on the case of Troy Davis, who was convicted of murder and executed in Georgia.
I think it'd be best if you chose something else to focus on. Take a yoga class.
A man's life is at stake and you want me to take a yoga class?
Allison, the man is guilty.
What if he's not?
And we're going to expand upon that conversation beyond the case to learn more about the death penalty and executions process here in Georgia and nationally. Rhonda Cook covered the criminal justice system and executions in Georgia since the 1990s for the AJC, and she joins us in the studio. Hello, Rhonda.
Hello there.
Welcome. Also with us is Maurice Shama. He's a staff writer for the Marshall Project. That's a nonprofit news organization covering criminal justice in the U.S. And Maurice, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Rhonda, just curious how you got onto this beat in the first place.
Well, it like a lot of things in my career, it was all an accident. I started covering prisons right out of the box when I became a reporter in 1977, and it just sort of evolved into this. And because I covered prisons, that led to the death penalty and execution, since they're the ones that carry out the punishment.
And the Department of Corrections selects 5 media witnesses for each execution. That's a role that you filled for dozens over the span of 2 decades or about there. The first execution you witnessed, that was in 1996. What do you remember about that day?
Well, I don't remember much about the executions I've covered. Some might argue it's a defensive thing. But
you mean you sort of blocked them out?
Yes. But I do remember, that's one of the two that I do remember, and it was Larry Longshar. And he was convicted of a triple murder. And Larry Longshar did not appeal his conviction. He sort of did right at the last minute, but then changed his mind the next day. And I do remember that one. That one was an electrocution. It's the only electrocution that I witnessed. But I do remember that one because it was my first, because I knew Longshar well. Because it was an electrocution, there are lots of reasons why I remember that one.
Mm, and you said there was another.
The other one that I do remember was Kelly Gissendanner a couple of years ago. She was convicted of having her lover kill her husband. And that one stands out not because Kelly Gissendanner is the only woman I've seen executed, but because she sang Amazing Grace right up until she could no longer sing. Mm. And that stands out.
That's pretty chilling. For you as a reporter, governed by the principles of objectivity, did witnessing all those executions leave you with any thoughts about capital punishment in Georgia or otherwise?
No, because I wasn't allowed to have those thoughts. Georgia is very efficient. The closest they've ever come to having a problem was with one of Kelly Gissendanner's, not the time she was executed, but the time before that. And they stepped in and stopped it because there was a problem with the drugs. It was cold. It had been stored at temperatures that were too cold. And the solids in the drug had begun to separate from the liquids. And so in an abundance of caution, they stopped that execution. And it was carried out about 6 months later. But Georgia has been drama free. They've got it pretty much down to it. There's a rhythm to it.
Maurice, this is something you've covered, death penalty stories all over the country. Georgia has had about 491 executions. This is since 1924. Rhonda mentioned the state's efficiency. How does Georgia compare to other states in terms of just the numbers?
I mean, it's kind of right in the middle. You know, you have states like Texas that carry out many, many executions and are almost kind of famous culturally for it. And then you have states that have abolished the death penalty totally. You have states that have the death penalty on the books and they sentence people to death, but then they sort of get squeamish about actually carrying out an execution. Georgia's right in the middle on that. You know, it carries out maybe 10 executions some years, a few less, a few more, but it's a state that kind of wants to kind of keep this system running in a kind of efficient way, like Rhonda said, but it also doesn't, you know, appear to want to kind of get the reputation of a place like Texas of being, you know, bloodthirsty or carrying these out over and over and over again. I mean, there were times, you know, in other states where there were two a week, and I don't know of examples like that in Georgia, though, you know, Rana, correct me if I'm wrong.
There's only one that I, there were a couple that I do recall, and one was the Larry Longshar. There was one that came the very next day. Mm-hmm. And then my memory tells me there was another one more recent, and those things tend to leave my mind after they're over.
Of course.
How many on death row now in Georgia?
I think there's around 55 or 6. I'm not really sure of the number, but it's somewhere between 50 and 60.
Go ahead, Maurice.
Oh, I was going to say that what happens is, you know, every state that carries out executions, no matter how many or how few, every once in a while, a case kind of pops up in the media and becomes a big deal. Sometimes it's because of issues with the lethal injection drugs, like the Kelly Kissendaner execution where those, you know, the pentobarbital separated. Other cases, it's like Troy Davis, where there's a really clear concern about someone being innocent, or in the case of Kelly Kissendaner, a woman, a kind of very sympathetic figure, and you find that these cases really kind of travel in the public mind because they kind of bring up a lot of ambivalence that people might have about the punishment.
And in her case, she was the person who was put to death while it was, I believe, her lover who actually committed the murder or was convicted of the murder?
No, that's correct. He agreed to a plea deal. And she declined to take the same. She had the same offer, and she did not take it. Mm-hmm. And so she went to trial, and then the jury chose the death sentence for her punishment.
And Maurice, this is you. Rhonda mentioned the first execution she saw was an electrocution. Later, lethal injection was adopted by the state of Georgia, something the Marshall Project has done a lot of reporting on. Tell us a little bit about some of the complications that states have had in obtaining lethal injection drugs for executions.
Sure. So lethal injections became the form of execution for a lot of states beginning in the 1980s and continuing up through the 90s. And the whole idea was that they would be a sort of more humane way of executing people, that it would kind of look more like a clinical sort of hospital setting. But in the late 2000s, around 2010-11, there was a problem with the production of one specific drug that was used in lethal injection. As a result, states had to kind of look to new sources, and defense lawyers kind of got wise to this, activists got wise to it, and they started putting pressure on pharmaceutical companies. And the result of all of this was that it became harder and harder for states to get the drugs, and that's where you started to see that the states that could get drugs, including Georgia, started to have problems with those drugs. They were getting them from less reputable or less regulated suppliers. There was a whole pretty zany story, frankly, involving states getting drugs from a sort of storefront in London that was the back of a driving school and like a strip mall. And this was the supplier that was getting drugs and shipping them over to the U.S. To departments of correction. A lot of bad press came with that. And then you started to see a few executions, not in Georgia, but in Oklahoma and Arizona and Ohio, in which there was what we would maybe call a botched execution, in which the person very visibly was in pain, gasping, failed to, prison officials failed to get a needle in, and just all kinds of gruesome stuff happened, and it suddenly kind of ruined in the public eye the idea that lethal injection was a kind of safe, humane, safe is a weird word because you are killing someone, but you know, sort of a humane way of doing it. And that is where we are now, where every once in a while you still hear about these kinds of problems accompanying lethal injection.
There is, incidentally, a terrific episode of More Perfect that's from the people at Radiolab about halting lethal injections. I am speaking with the former AJC reporter Rhonda Cook and staff writer for the Marshall Project. His name is Maurice Shama, about the death penalty and execution process here in Georgia. And Rhonda, I want to go back to the Troy Davis case for a moment and play a clip from Annalise McPhail. She's the mother of Mark McPhail, the police officer that Troy Davis was accused of murdering. Here she is speaking to CNN in the lead up to Davis's execution.
I never get closure. I may get some peace because Mark will always be in my heart and in my life.
Now, Rhonda, you covered this case for the AJC there for his execution in 2011. Did you have any sense that it would be such a pivotal case, not just in Georgia, but nationally, even internationally?
Well, yeah, we saw the lead up to it. There were people weighing in, like President Carter, the Pope. It was getting attention from all over the world, and it just intensified the closer we got to the date of execution. And he had four dates. He had three stays at the last minute. So it was a crescendo, and you could see it coming.
Well, why do you think the case got so much attention? Was it about the dynamics or the specifics of the case?
A little of both. You had his family, Troy Davis's family, was very good with the media and very good at getting folks behind them. And it went from there. His sister, who passed away not long after he was executed, she had cancer. She was the force behind all of this. And it was like a storm. And they had folks coming up behind them and supporting their position. And then you had seven of the nine witnesses who testified against him sort of back off their testimony. Mm. That has happened in other cases that I've covered. And consequently, then you'd have jurors saying, well, we've had second thoughts. And that's happened in other cases I've covered as well. But it just took on a life that it was a force. It was very strong. So that's, I think, what brought it so much attention.
Well, Troy Davis was not the first person in Georgia whose execution stirred up protests or across the country. And Maurice, this is something that you have covered. The death penalty in Georgia and other places, undeniably more African Americans are put to death and more people raised in poverty get the death sentence. So how do race and class play into who is on death row?
In sort of surprising and complex ways, Georgia was actually the site of a major study of who was sentenced to death and their race that became pivotal in a 1980s Supreme Court case called McCleskey versus Kemp. That was a really big deal because it was one of the first times since the 70s that the death penalty kind of as a whole was being attacked in a really big way and at a national level. And it came out of Georgia. And what that study at the time found was that if you were black, you were slightly more likely to be sentenced to death, but you were overwhelmingly more likely to be sentenced to death if the victim was white. That seemed to be the kind of main lesson from this research. Since then, there's been studies around the country. They tend to all show a version of that, maybe a stronger correlation with being black. This actually drove last week the Supreme Court in Washington State to strike down the death penalty there, saying, the evidence basically shows that this is arbitrary, but also, filled with racial disparities in a way that we're not comfortable with and that violates the Constitution. So, you see that kind of coming up more and more in the arguments that people make. You also see occasional cases where racism is so explicit that it's just kind of undeniable, like a juror who uses the N-word, a prosecutor who goes out of their way to make sure there are no black members of the jury, that sort of thing. And then on the class side of it, you tend to see, there's in defense lawyer circles, it's sort of well known that there's no one independently wealthy on death row because, most of these people are represented by court-appointed lawyers, and often those lawyers don't really have the resources to do a very good job, or they do their best, but they are sort of way overmatched by the state. And so, one quip I've heard a defense lawyer say to me very skeptically is that, those on death row didn't commit the worst crimes, they just had the worst lawyers. Mm. And I think that that's often borne out. I mean, there are also a lot of people on death row who committed very, very sort of atrocious, scary crimes. But there are also people who are not on death row who committed very scary and atrocious crimes as well. So sometimes, you're always making these decisions. It's necessarily a kind of subjective thing. But every scholar who has looked at this really closely tends to see at least some effect of race and class.
You said that Washington Supreme Court struck down the death penalty. What is happening nationally in public opinion and the actual political or policy decisions about the death penalty?
I think it's really in flux. You have a lot of states that are having these kind of big public debates about whether they want to have the death penalty. So in addition to Washington, Nebraska, the legislature voted down the death penalty there, but then the public, through a referendum, basically overruled the legislature and brought it back, and they carried out an execution last year. I've spent a lot of time covering a case in Nevada where a man is kind of like the case Rhonda mentioned earlier. He's given up his appeals and is asking to be executed, and the state can't seem to get it together to make it happen. So you see just a lot of kind of these chaotic, you know, turmoil-filled moments around individual executions. But overall, what we've seen is that the public, in, you know, most of the polls that get done on this, still support the death penalty, but not nearly by the margin that they used to. You know, it hovers around 50%, maybe a little more, but there were times in the 90s where it was, you know, 60, 70, 80%, especially in states like Georgia and Texas. So we've seen definitely an ebb in terms of public support for this. And it kind of suggests that, you know, maybe public support is a little bit tied to how much we're doing it. There's also just been such a decline in the use of the death penalty that maybe it's less that people are against it than they are just sort of apathetic, and you don't necessarily see that in the polls. But I think that individual opinions can be pretty complicated.
And Rhonda, just I want to close with you and ask, have you seen that change here in the state of Georgia, fewer people supporting the death penalty?
Well, yes, I've seen it in terms of media coverage and the number of people who come out and protest the executions. The last few that I covered, that I witnessed, there would be no one out there from the media for us to report to. There would be a few of the usual protesters, and they would sort of pack up and leave as soon as it was over.
Rhonda Cook, she's former reporter for the AJC. She covered the criminal justice system. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Happy to be here.
Also, Maurice Shama, he's staff writer for the Marshall Project. Thank you so much, Maurice.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now, the music we're hearing is from the Troy Davis radio drama. It's called Strange Dog Walk by Blue Dot Sessions. And stay with us. We're going to take a turn here and speak with cybersecurity experts gathering in Atlanta this week on how to keep our personal data and national elections safe. This is On Second Thought.